First of all, why is the book called 2 Timothy? At the beginning of the book in my Bible, you have those words, 2 Timothy, and then it's at the top of each page, 2 Timothy. Why is it called 2 Timothy? Moses first, I think. Because it is a letter, and it was sent to a man called Timothy, and like you say, it was Paul's second letter to Timothy. We know who wrote it. It was Paul. You just told me that. Where was Paul when he wrote this letter? Go on, Katie, this time.
In a prison.
He was in a prison. And this prison was in the city of... Bethan.
No.
In the city of Rome, in Italy. Paul was in Italy, he was in the city of Rome, and he was in prison in Rome. And from that prison in Rome, he sent this letter to Timothy. Now, where was Timothy? James Henry. He was in Ephesus, which was a long, long way away from Rome. Ephesus was in the country that we now call, didn't have the name then, but nowadays we call the country, Caleb? Not Israel, though. No. Sophie? Turkey. Yes. Ephesus was in the country that we now call Turkey, and the ruins of ancient Ephesus are still there. I've been to them. I've wandered round the ruins of old Ephesus. I've wandered round the places where Timothy would have walked and sat. You can still go and visit Ephesus. So you get Paul, who's in prison in Rome, and first he sent one letter to Timothy in Ephesus, and then he sent a second letter to Timothy in Ephesus, and that's this letter, which we call 2 Timothy. Next question, why did Paul write this letter? That's a much harder one, because really that's everything we've been saying for the last 2 years, isn't it? But see if you can tell me in a sentence or two, why did Paul write this letter? Back to Bethan, I think. Go on, have a go. To help Timothy. That's a very good answer. Three words. You see, it takes me 2 years to say it. But Bethan can say it in three words. That is excellent. He wrote it to help Timothy. And why particularly did Timothy need help? What work was Timothy doing in Ephesus? Back to James Henry. He was preaching. He was working in a church like this. He was trying to teach and preach in that church. And we've said that lots of things in that church were going wrong. And there were lots of problems in that church. And Timothy had to sort them out. And Paul sent this letter to say, look, Timothy, just keep at it. Keep working there. Don't give up. Be brave. And he was telling Timothy how to handle the different problems. So you've got Paul in prison in Rome sending this second letter to Timothy in Ephesus to help him. What was Paul waiting for there in prison? What was going to happen to Paul? Back to Moses. He was going to be executed. He knew that one day somebody would come to him and say, right, you're going to be put on trial today. And then he was going to be taken to a courtroom, and there he would be tried. Who would the judge be in the trial? Go on, Bethan. The king, that's quite right, the king of Rome, but the name we give to the king of Rome, the special title of the king of Rome was the, another word for a king, but a king over a big, big area. Yeah, Caleb? Caesar, that was his name. You're doing better than I thought. And the title, yes, James Henry, the emperor. Whew. So we can call him the king if you like, we can call him Caesar, we can call him the emperor. Paul was going to be tried, and the emperor was going to be his judge, the most important man in the whole of the world. And really, Paul knew already what was going to happen at this trial. The emperor would say, you're guilty, you're a traitor, you're a troublemaker, you're going to be put to death. And then Paul would be taken off, and his head would be chopped off. That's what Paul's expecting. That's what Paul's waiting for. Now, I want you to try to imagine what it was like for Paul there in prison. Let's try and imagine the room in which Paul was kept. I mean, of course, we don't know exactly what it was like, but we can have a pretty good idea of what it was like, because people have dug down and they found the ruins of old prisons from that time. Let's imagine a room that's about a quarter of the size of this room. So we'll split this room down the middle that way, and then we'll split it down the middle this way, so we'll just have this corner of this room, so the people on this side of the aisle, and going back as far as Nye and Fiona, you've got a room about so big. And the walls and the floor are made of big blocks of bare stone. And it's quite dark in that room. There may be one small window, like one of those windows, quite high up in the wall. And it's got iron bars across it. Or there may be no windows at all. There may just be an oil lamp burning in one corner to give light to the room. And in that room, there are maybe 20 or 30 prisoners. They're sitting or lying down on straw mattresses around the walls. And they've got iron rings round their wrists and round their ankles. And the rings are fastened to chains, and the chains run to staples in the wall. There's no other furniture in that room. There are just a few pots and buckets, and a wooden bench, I should think, by the door. Most of the men in that room are very dirty. Their hair is long. They've got beards that haven't been cut for a long time. And some of them are scratching themselves because they've got fleas or lice in their hair. And they're very thin because they don't get a lot of food. And the room smells horrible because some of these men have been there for months and they've not changed their clothes in all that time. And there are no toilets in the cell. They have to use the buckets. And the room's very noisy because some of the men in that room are arguing and some of them are shouting. Maybe some of them have gone mad. And they just sit there and talk to themselves all day, just nonsense. And maybe others just lie there on their mattresses in silence. They've given up. There are a couple of Roman soldiers keeping guard. They're sitting on that bench by the door. People are allowed to visit the prisoners. If a prisoner's got friends, then his friends can come to the prison. And he can ask to visit the prisoners, and he can bring in food for them and clean clothes. And the visitor can stay and chat with the prisoners all day if he wants to, and if he can stand the smell. Of course, not all prisons were quite as bad as that. There were some prisons that were kept for special prisoners, political prisoners, rich prisoners. Maybe those prisons were more comfortable. But Paul wasn't kept in one of those special prisons. He was in a prison just for common criminals. He was there alongside people who had stolen something or committed murder. He says in chapter 2 and verse 9, I'm suffering even to the point of being chained like a criminal. He's treated just like an ordinary criminal. So he's going to be in a very unpleasant prison. That was the sort of place Paul was in when he wrote this letter. I say he wrote this letter. I shouldn't think he actually wrote it down himself. We know that Paul had very weak eyes. Paul found it difficult to write anything. So Paul usually dictated his letters. He spoke the words, and then he got someone else to write them down for him. And he would just sign his name in big letters at the end of the letter. I think that's probably what he had to do in that dark prison cell. I don't think he'd have been able to write clearly himself. It was in a place like that that Paul spent the last days of his life. We don't know how long he was actually there. Maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months. But that's where Paul had to spend his time until he was brought out and taken to the emperor and found guilty and put to death. Sometimes I wonder where I'll spend the last days of my life. Of course, my life could end suddenly. A sudden blowout on the motorway. A heart attack. I could be dead in a moment, without any warning. But for most of us, there is a time when we know that death is approaching. We know we've only got a few weeks or a few months to live. Well, where will I spend those weeks or months? You know, it'd be nice to think that it'd be my own home, with my family and my friends around me, in an atmosphere of peace, in an atmosphere of comfort. It'd be nice to think I could be there just quietly preparing myself to leave this world. It would be nice if I had Christian friends who just came in and sat on the end of the bed and sang hymns that I loved. It'd be lovely if it were that sort of atmosphere in which I spent my last days. Perhaps I'd have an illness that didn't actually cause any pain, but just meant that I got weaker each day until finally I fell asleep and woke up again in the presence of the Lord Jesus. It would be lovely if it were like that. But there's no guarantee at all that it will be like that for me. It wasn't like that for Paul. His last days were spent in a dark, smelly prison cell. His last days were spent chained to a wall. His last nights were spent being kept awake by people sobbing or by the shouting of other prisoners, by the changing of the guard. His last days were spent struggling to find a comfortable position where the chains wouldn't rub his ankles and his wrists. And for some of us, it may be like that. Some of us may spend our last days in prison. Persecution days are coming closer all the time. Some of us may spend our last days locked up in a psychiatric ward because of our bizarre Christian delusions. And we'll be there along with the psychopaths and the psychotics. Some of us may spend our last days in grim nursing homes. You know, there are wonderful nursing homes. We thank God for them. But there are also many nursing homes that are horrible, inhuman places. I know nursing homes where residents are terribly neglected and ill-treated. There are somewhere a handful of residents who have still got clear minds have to share a sitting room with dozens of folk who have lost their minds and who shout and rave and curse all day long. I can think of some of the terrible nursing homes I visited where patients just sit there all day and nobody ever talks to them. And there's just a TV set just blaring out noise at one end of the room. And nobody watches it. All the patients are just permanently sedated to keep them quiet. Well, I could finish up in one of those places. That may be where I'll spend the last months of my life. And it may be where you'll spend the last days of yours. I may spend the last days of my life in terrible pain. You know, we've heard the debates this week about euthanasia, haven't we? Well, the fact is that in God's providence, many believers will spend their last months in great and growing pain. I may spend the last days of my life lonely, cut off from the people whom I love and trust. I may spend the rest of the last days of my life surrounded by ungodly people with horrible, foul conversation all around me and blaring jungle music battering at me. I may spend the last days of my life stone deaf and completely blind, unable to hear a word of comfort. None of us knows what our situation will be during those last weeks or months or years that we have to live through before we die. And that can be a very frightening thought. There are believers who really dread the thought of that last stage and all the uncertainties. Now, there are Christians who have said to me, I'm not afraid of dying, but I am frightened when I think of what it could be like in the run-up towards death. I'm frightened at the thought of being helpless. I'm frightened that I might have to move out of my own home. I'm frightened of pain. Those are natural fears, and Satan can take those natural fears and he can amplify them. And he can turn them into nagging terror at the back of our minds as we think about the last stage of our lives here on earth. Well, this morning we're beginning to look at the very last section of 2 Timothy, chapter 4, verse 9 onwards. And I am so thankful to God that we have this passage in our Bibles. Because you can see here what Paul wrote there in that prison cell, in that horrible situation. What Paul wrote when he was chained to that wall. What Paul wrote in that semi-darkness, in the stench. And you can see the grace that God gave him in that horrible situation. You can see the way that he was sustained by the marvelous grace of Jesus Christ. And you can be sure that if you are a believer, that God can give you grace for whatever you have to face during the last stage of your life here on earth. If the Lord Jesus could sustain Paul there in that situation, if Jesus could give him grace to help in his time of need, then surely the Lord Jesus can give us grace to help in our times of need. We don't know what lies ahead for us. We don't know what our circumstances will be. But we can say, just as Jesus Christ kept Paul, so Jesus Christ can keep me, whatever the situation might be. There are seven things I want you to see about Paul here in the last section of the book, from verse 9 onwards. And I don't expect to cover the seven this morning, but over the next two or three Sunday mornings. The first thing is this. Paul is suffering to the end. Paul is suffering to the end. Now, Paul doesn't say very much about his suffering. He's very restrained when it comes to talking about himself and what he's going through. He could have written all about the chains and how painful they were. And he could have complained about how little sleep he was getting. He could have written page after page of self-pity. But that's not Paul. But still, when you read between the lines, you can't miss the fact that he is suffering. He's lonely. That's what you see in verses 9 and 10. He writes to Timothy, "Do your best to come to me quickly." Why? Why does he want Timothy to come to him? Why does he plead with him to do his best? Why does he say, "Please come quickly, Timothy"? Why? Because he's lonely. Nearly all his friends have gone. There's Demas, verse 10. Well, Demas has gone off and left Paul. Demas had been a very close friend of Paul's for many years. You meet Demas in Colossians chapter 4 and in the book of Philemon. Paul trusted Demas, but Demas has let him down. He says, "Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me and gone off to Thessalonica. Demas wanted an easy life here in this world, and so Demas ran away when Paul needed him most." And then there's Crescens and Titus, who are mentioned in verse 10. They've gone off as well. Now, Paul doesn't blame them. They've gone off for good reasons. They've got work to do elsewhere. But he still misses them. Paul himself has sent Tychicus away. In verse 12, "I sent Tychicus to Ephesus." I think he may well be the messenger who's carrying this letter for Paul. To Ephesus. And now he'll have to stand in for Timothy if Timothy comes and visits Paul. These were the men who were Paul's closest friends. These were his own team members. These were the people who had come with him to Rome. And none of them were there for him during the last stage of his life. They'd all had to go off for one reason or another. There were other close friends, other team members who never got to Rome. Verse 20, Erastus was needed in Corinth. And Trophimus fell ill and stayed in Miletus. God in his wisdom took all these people away from Paul. In fact, the only one of Paul's teammates, the only one of Paul's intimate circle, his family, if you like, who was there with him in the prison visiting him, was Luke, who's mentioned in verse 11. Well, we can thank God that there was one man there to be a comfort and encouragement to Paul, and that one was a doctor. Luke was Paul's beloved physician. And of course, Luke was also a brilliant writer. He may well have been the man to whom Paul dictated this letter. Well, Paul is glad to have Luke, but he's still lonely. And that's why he's pleading with Timothy to come. Look, verse 9, he says it, "Do your best to come to me quickly." And then, as if that isn't emphatic enough, verse 21, he can't sign off the letter without saying it again. "Please do your best to get here before winter. Please try, Timothy. Please try to get here. You know, if you don't get here before winter, it'll be next year because you won't be able to travel through the winter. And this time next year, Timothy, I'll be dead. Timothy, I want to see you before I die. Timothy, you're my son, and I'm missing you. Please try." You can almost hear the desperation in Paul's voice. He says, "Please try to get here before winter." Paul feels lonely. And he feels betrayed. It's not just Demas. He's gone off and left Paul. But there are other people who have let Paul down as well. After all, there is a church in Rome, and that church has got some fine, gifted Christians in it. And Paul lists some of them in the second half of verse 21. Eubulus greets you, Timothy, and so do Pudens and Linus and Claudia and all the brothers. These Christians in Rome obviously are in touch with Paul. They're sending their greetings through Paul to Timothy. But Paul still has to say in verse 16, at my first defence, no one came to my support, but everyone deserted me. Not one of those Christians from Rome turned up in court to support Paul. Not one of them was willing to give him a character reference. Well, Paul's not bitter. He says, may it not be held against them. But surely he's still sad. We're always sad, aren't we, when people whom we thought better of, people we've tried to help, people who call themselves our friends, we're always sad, aren't we, when they let us down, when we need them most. And Paul is having that experience. Paul feels lonely, and Paul feels betrayed. And more than that, Paul feels cold. Look what he says to Timothy in verse 13. When you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas. On one of his journeys, Paul left his overcoat in the house of a friend. Maybe it was just before he was arrested. Maybe he never had time to collect it. But now Paul writes to Timothy, and he says, winter's coming, and I'm going to need that coat. Can you collect it from Troas, from Carpus's house? Can you bring it with you? Well, it says something, doesn't it, about the situation Paul was in, that he didn't have a warm garment to wear. And apparently, nobody brought him one. Why couldn't Luke have gone out into the marketplace and bought a cloak for Paul, instead of Paul having to wait to see if Timothy turned up with one from hundreds of miles away? Well, presumably what it means is that Luke couldn't afford to buy one for Paul. And it would seem that there wasn't anybody in the whole church in Rome who offered to lend Paul a garment. That's how desperate Paul's situation was. That's how destitute he was. And if Paul and Luke had no money to buy a cloak, then I don't suppose they had a lot of money for food either, or for anything else. Paul was living in abject poverty. He couldn't afford any of the comforts of life. If he was cold at night in his cell, well, I guess he was hungry as well. Can you picture Paul at night, shivering, wishing he had a warm blanket? Can you imagine Paul just wishing that he could get at least one regular meal a day? Paul has had a life of suffering for the sake of Jesus Christ. Paul's been beaten so often. He's been stoned. He's been injured. He's given up everything and has lived in poverty. He's been lonely so often. He's been betrayed and disappointed and let down again and again. And you might think, well, surely God will allow a let up at the end of his days. Surely Paul's entitled to that. Surely he'll be allowed to spend his last months in dignity and comfort and peace. But it wasn't so. Paul suffered to the bitter end. Loneliness, betrayal, poverty, those were Paul's experiences till the day of his death. That's my first point. Suffering to the end. Second thing I see here is that Paul was working to the end. Paul has said in verse 7, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. In one sense, Paul's work is finished. He's no longer going to be travelling the world. He's no longer going to be going planting churches in different cities. He's no longer going to have a public preaching ministry. All that's finished. Well, it would be understandable, wouldn't it, if now Paul in that prison cell said, "Look, I've got no energy left. Look, I've done my share. I've done more than my share. I'm just going to rest now. I'm just going to try and just cope with my own situation now." Plenty of believers do react that way. Perhaps a man's been a preacher, working hard for the Lord for many years, and then he retires, and he moves away with his wife to a nice town by the seaside, and he joins a church there, and he goes along to the meetings each week, but basically he decides that now he's on the retirement list and he's entitled to rest. So he spends his days pottering around the garden or strolling along the prom, just doing all the things that he never had time to do before he retired, developing a few hobbies. He feels he's earned the right to take it easy for the last lap. Maybe he has. I'm not in a position to judge him. All I can say is that Paul never thought of it that way. Paul, in those last months of his life, was working. In one sense, Paul couldn't do very much. I mean, what can you do chained to a wall in a dark prison cell with a prison guard looking over your shoulder? But Paul is determined that with the breath he's still got and with the little energy that still remains, he's going to do what he can. Look at verse 11. Paul says to Timothy, "Get Mark and bring him with you, because he's helpful to me in my ministry." Well, if Paul had talked about his ministry 2 years earlier, then we would all have understood what he meant. Paul's ministry as a missionary, Paul's ministry as a church planter, Paul's ministry as a great preacher. Well, Paul is chained to a wall in a prison cell, and he's still talking about my ministry. As far as he's concerned, he has still got a ministry that he must perform. The word ministry just means service. It means the work that a servant does for his master. Well, Paul there in his prison cell is saying, "I am still a servant now. There's no retirement from the service of Jesus Christ." You can't say, "Well, I'm 65 now, and it's time for me to retire from the service of Jesus." Paul says, "I've still got a master. I'm still a servant. I've still got work to do. And the reason I want Mark here with me is because he can help me in my service." You see, Paul has still got plans for work he can do from that prison cell. Instead of saying, "Oh dear, well, my opportunities have gone now." Instead of just reminiscing nostalgically about the great days when he could work for the Lord, Paul's fertile brain is still thinking up schemes there in the prison cell, ways in which he can work for God. And he says, "But I need some helpers in this. So let's get Mark here. Mark can help me in my service." Paul can't go out from that prison cell, but he can still direct operations. Maybe Paul has heard about a group of believers in Rome who don't have any teaching, and Paul still feels responsible for them. So if Mark comes, well, Paul can put him in charge of that group, and he can give Mark the material that Mark needs to teach them. Maybe there's a new gospel opportunity opened up among a group of Jewish Pharisees who once heard Paul preach and they want to hear more. Well, Paul can teach them via Mark. You know, you sometimes hear, don't you, of a gangland boss who's been locked up in prison, but he doesn't give up his criminal career. He's still, from his prison cell, he's still planning this heist or that job. And he's still sending out his minions to do them. Well, Paul's no different. He said it's not criminal activity he's involved in, it's gospel activity. And he'll use men like Luke and Mark and Timothy to do it. He was the one who sent Tychicus to Ephesus to fill a gap there. And that prison cell in Rome, it's become the head office of World Mission Unlimited. And Paul is still the managing director. He refuses to give up working. There's work I can do here in this situation. I may be half blind. I may not be able to move more than 3 or 4 foot. I may be hungry. But I can still work. I'm going to work. As long as I've got a breath in my body, I'm going to find something I can do for Jesus Christ. You can see another way Paul is working in verse 13. Paul asks Timothy for his cloak. He also asks him to bring something else that's been left behind in Carpus's home. Paul asks for my scrolls, my books, and especially the parchments. Paul has left some books behind in Carpus's home, and Paul wants those books. We don't know what the books were. Maybe they were copies of the Old Testament scriptures, though I suspect Paul would have known those off by heart anyway. Maybe they were books by other people, other Christian leaders like Peter or John. Maybe they were some of his own writings. Maybe they were non-Christian books that needed answering, books by godless philosophers or heretics. But one way or another, Paul wanted his books. Paul wanted to get back to studying. He wanted to carry on reading, or getting somebody to read to him if he couldn't make out the words himself. Maybe he wanted to get back to writing. Paul isn't saying, well, I've only got a few months left in this world. I don't think there's any point in my doing any more studying. After all, what use will it be to me? Paul's saying, bring me my books. Bring me resources for study. And I need them here. As long as Paul's got a brain, Paul is going to be using that brain for the service of Jesus Christ. Now, isn't there some encouragement here for you? As we think about what our own lives may hold, as we think about what may come to us in the last months, in the last lap of our life here on earth. Yes, it may be full of suffering. Yes, it may be full of all sorts of frustrations and limitations. But that doesn't mean that it has to be wasted time. It doesn't mean that there will be nothing for us to do for Jesus Christ. There will be work that you will be able to do for Jesus Christ if you have a heart to do it. Paul found things he could do for Jesus Christ. And all the limitations he was working under couldn't prevent him from serving the master he loved. This letter that he wrote, we fed on it for 2 years. It was written there in that prison cell. That was part of his work. And we're still getting the benefit of it. And millions upon millions of believers all down through the centuries have received the benefit of the work Paul did in that prison cell. So sad, isn't it? Some people reach a stage in their life when depression overtakes them and they say, I'm useless now. I'm useless. There's nothing I can do that will be useful. Nobody wants me. Nobody wants my gifts. Nobody wants my experience. Paul won't let himself get depressed like that. As far as he's concerned, if he's in that situation, it's to do work that he couldn't do anywhere else. And he will do it by the power of the Holy Spirit within him. Paul is still working. It would be easy, wouldn't it, to go to the opposite extreme and start dreaming nostalgically, or that's not the word I want, start dreaming sort of sentimentally about wonderful things that you will do to honour Christ in the last months of your life. The useful work you will do then. The wonderful testimony you will have then. The wonderful patience and grace that you'll show then. The letters you'll write then. The people you'll witness to then. Paul didn't start working when he went into that prison cell. Paul has been working with all his energy all those years. You know, but if Paul could work under those circumstances, if Paul can push himself to work for Christ there, what excuse do we have for life's of idleness now? When we've got our freedom, none of us are chained up, incapable of moving. None of us are living in half darkness. None of us are restricted as Paul was. None of us are completely destitute. We've got freedom to work for Christ. We've got opportunities. We've got resources. You remember the story of the talents? Well, if you'd asked Paul, what have you got? What resources have you got to use in the service of Christ here in this prison cell? He'd have had to say, not a lot. But everything I have got, I'm going to use. Well, our hands are full of talents, resources, opportunities that can be used for Jesus Christ. What are you going to do for Jesus Christ today? When you come to the end of this day, and you ask yourself the question, have I worked for Jesus Christ today? What work have I done for him today? What are you going to say? On the day of judgment, we're going to be asked that question. What work have you done for Jesus Christ with your life? But we don't live our lives a life at a time. We live our lives a day at a time, an hour at a time, a minute at a time. If you want to be able to answer the question on the day of judgment, then it means using this minute, this hour, this day for Jesus Christ. And then when you come to the end of your life, when you come to judgment day, you'll be able to say, I have used my life for Jesus Christ.